Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Now, we're going to be sort of converging that in with the power of your creative self. How many of you listening say, I don't have an artistic bone in my body? I don't have a creative bone in my body. Well, we all know that that's not true. Creativity manifests itself in multiple ways, and so many, many different levels of expression. That when we start having that kind of an attitude, we actually stifle something that is within us that can make our life much richer. My guest today is Eric Maisel, and we are going to be talking about a book that he's come out with, and he's written so many, but this one is about making your creative mark. And he gives you 9 keys so that you can achieve your artistic creative goal. I don't care if it's painting a bedroom wall with a bunch of ducks. It doesn't make any difference. Or if you want to be a Van Gogh, or you want to be a Michelangelo, anything and everything from the ducks to the great, it makes no difference. I want to welcome Eric Maisel to the show. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Donna. How are you?
Well, I'm doing magnificently. Now, you have a fascinating line of work. You're a creativity coach, and I know that you've done over 40 books. You have had your own column. You've blogged for Fine Art America and Psychology, and you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is renowned for creativity. What turned you on to becoming a creative coach? This is something that not many people would even give 5 seconds of time to wrapping their mind around. What compelled you to do it?
It was a journey, as all of these adventures are. It was a journey. I started out a long time ago in math and science. I thought I would be an astronomer or a physicist or something like that. And as soon as I got to the real math, I saw I didn't enjoy that much. And I enlisted in the Army way back in 1965, so we're talking about a long time ago. And when I got out, I became a philosophy major, which is the thing you do when you have no idea what you're doing. And I started writing fiction a long time ago, and I wrote many, many novels. And we had we had young kids and a growing family, so I was seeing that it wasn't sort of fair or responsible to continue on that path if it wasn't making enough money. So I retooled and became a psychotherapist. And when I became a psychotherapist, I thought it would be smart or enjoyable to work with creative and performing artists because their issues interested me. And that's what I did. I specialized in working with artists. But then, very quickly, I didn't like the medical model of psychotherapy. I didn't think I was diagnosing and treating mental disorders. I thought I was just dealing with the problems of people. So I segued away from psychotherapy to what I called creativity consulting because there wasn't even a coaching world at that moment, really. And then when coaching became a popular thing, when life coaching and other kinds of coaching became popular, I started using that word, and I called myself a creativity coach. This is still maybe 20 years ago, and I've been working as a creativity coach for the last 20 years, training creativity coaches. There are many of us out there now, and it's a wonderful line of work. It's hard work because, as you know, creative folks have tons of challenges. It's a hard marketplace. It's a hard job to do. It's a hard personality to deal with. So the work is hard, but it's very rewarding, and I've been doing it for a long time now.
Well, I can totally empathize with what you do, because I think in the process of reading your book, it became very much obvious to me that, one, you have a passion for people, two, you really enjoy empowering them, and three, you love to see their creative self soar so that they become more aware of that which is spurring them to be creative. And it, you have so many different stories in your book, and I totally, totally empathize with that, because it is a joy to me as a counselor when I can see people breaking the glass ceilings that they've put upon themselves. And let's face it, we all do it. My goodness, I can't say that I haven't done it. Of course I have. You have. Everybody does. But it's understanding that we can break, and I'll use the terminology, our glass ceilings, our paradigms, whatever term you're most comfortable
yep.
with, and grow into the greatness that you really are. I really liked the very first sentence on your first page in chapter one. And it is, your first task as a creative person is to mind your mind and think thoughts that serve you. That one sentence encompasses a lot of what's in your book. And I think that this is not something that generally, culturally, I don't care where you come from in the world, that typically is encouraged, because usually it's the opposite. Whatever society you're born into, whatever environment surrounds you, wants to dominate and give instruction and give structure. Well, all of that is fine. That's not a bad thing in many respects. But when you are someone that wants to break through seemingly impossible barriers, people usually say, don't rock the boat. You can't afford to do that. I mean, how many times have we heard that? I mean, that is just over and over and over again. You're an odd duck. You don't fit into the mold. I mean, all kinds of stuff is slammed out at people that have that desire to walk to their own drummer. And this is what you begin your book with, is to minding the mind. Let's talk about self-sabotage a little bit, because that's in your first chapter.
Sure.
Oh, my Lord, when I think of how many times I've self-sabotaged myself through my life, I just go, oh, please, do we have to review that again? But
yeah.
Yes, I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, some people at least are a little savvy about how negative self-talk affects them, how saying, you know, I'm not talented, or I'm an imposter, or it's too late, or there's too much competition, or they have a sense of how that's negatively affecting them. What they may not know is how tricky they are, how tricky their self-talk is. And nowadays, creative people or would-be creative people are saying the following two things to themselves all the time to avoid getting on with their creative work. And those two things are, I'm too tired and I'm too busy. And those things work to get us off the hook, because we do get tired and we are very busy. So we know how to say things to ourselves that sound 100% true. They're only 46% true, but they sound 100% true, and therefore we don't get on with our creative work. So part of getting a grip on your mind is just realizing how tricky our own self-talk is. And a second point is, because my creative clients, creative people in general, also often smart people, they put a high premium on rationality. They think that, you know, true thoughts ought to be countenanced just because they're true. And that isn't the case. If you think a true thought, like there are a lot of writers out there, that's a true thought. But that's not a thought that may be serving you. So you don't have to be held hostage to true thoughts. If you hear yourself thinking a thought that's true, but that also doesn't serve you, you want to reject it. You know, you want to say, yeah, there are a lot of writers out there, but that thought doesn't serve me. Because if you don't reject those true thoughts, what's going to happen is, not in the next minute, but 2 days from now, you're going to block and quit on your novel. Because those thoughts have those kinds of consequences. When we think thoughts like those, like there are so many writers out there, even though it's a true thought, it's going to cost us down the road. So we want to get much smarter about disputing even true thoughts and making sure that we're only thinking thoughts that serve us.
I really liked your story about an artist, and you just didn't give him a name. You just said, a painter opens his email and is thrilled to find a note from someone who owns a nice gallery in a faraway city. The gallery wants to exhibit the painting, but they want to know what to charge. And of course, I love this story because I could relate to it, and I know of so many other people that could relate to it, because the the artist is just going into a panic. He doesn't know what to charge. What do I charge? Do I charge 5 cents or $500 million? What do I do? I have no idea. And a friend of his comes along and calls the gallery, does a process, share that story. I loved it. I thought, boy, can this hit home.
Yeah, because it covers a couple of the different keys that I'm talking about, and one is the confidence key. And often, because the marketplace is a mysterious business to everybody, including players in the marketplace, you know, there isn't a gallery owner or literary agent who really knows what's going on at this split second as the universe keeps changing. But because the marketplace is such a mysterious place, the average creative or performing artist really doesn't feel very confident with respect to dealing with the marketplace and starts to hide out and not ask the most obvious questions or the most useful questions. So what the story is about is the following simple thing. This fellow gets the exciting email that his paintings may be wanted, and really all he needs to do is provide a price, and he can't do that. And what we do typically when we get anxious is we flee the encounter. That's the number one thing human beings do when they get anxious. If they're afraid of flying, they stay away from airports. If they're afraid of the marketplace, they stay away from it. So this painter's reaction is to sort of hide, but by accident, he talks to a more savvy or more confident or more businesslike artist who says, it's a simple job here. It's really tremendously simple. I'll model it for you. I'm going to call them and ask them what they think you ought to be charging. And as it turns out, that artist holds a very reasonable conversation with the gallery owner, and some numbers are arrived at, and this whole process works out well. And so the headline takeaway from the story is that we must not flee from the marketplace. We must not hide out. We want to do just the most natural things. It's not amazingly difficult to think of making a phone call, and yet it feels that difficult. It feels that difficult in part because we get so scared dealing with marketplace players. As you know, the number one phobia in the world is public speaking. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to be surprisingly afraid of saying two sentences in public. So if that's the case, if we have that much anxiety just about speaking two sentences in public, how much more anxiety is generated when we have to deal with marketplace players where the outcomes really matter to us?
Mm-hmm.
So to come to the end of that thought, the only last thing I would want to say is because marketplace interactions generate so much anxiety, and they do, all creative people need a few anxiety management strategies in place that actually work for them, not just that they think will work or that intellectually work or that they've read about, but that they've actually practiced and know how to use so that they can reduce their anxiety when they have to engage in these marketplace interactions.
You talk about passion. Now, I know as soon as someone hears that word, they automatically think of two lovers in an extremely passionate embrace. That's usually the first picture that comes into mind. However, passion for life is something that when you meet somebody that has it, it's totally invigorating. It absolutely is. And the creative person often gets so distorted in what they think that is. And I liked your including in your book the quote by Pavarotti, how people thought he was so disciplined, but he said it was really devotion. When he went to rehearse, yes, that is a discipline. But when you love what you're doing, and he loved music so much, to him, it was just this passion that he had for music, and he was devoted to it. This is something that he wanted to do more than anything else in the world. And yes. I really like that point. That was a wonderful positioning to come from.
Yeah, it's a huge point, and not to overstate the obvious, but it's clear that he wasn't disciplined in other parts of his life, and I don't think any of us really can be disciplined if we're going against our own desires. It's really hard to be disciplined, and I don't think creative people can white-knuckle discipline and just make themselves sit and do something year in and year out if they're not enthusiastic about it, if they're not if they don't have some love for what they're doing, if they don't have some enthusiasm, some curiosity, you can't just do it from a mere interest place. I have lots of clients, and there are millions of people out there who move from one mere interest to the next. They take a photography class, and the next week it's a watercolor class, and next week it's a poetry class.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no love underneath. There's interest, but interest isn't enough to sustain creative work, because creative work's pretty hard. Mere interest isn't enough to sustain creative work over time. That's why so many people are disappointed with themselves, disappointed in having all these art supplies that they've bought over the years, or taken so many classes, done so many workshops, tried so many things. They haven't settled anywhere, and they haven't really gone deep anyplace. And it's because they've been operating on the level of mere interest. You have to fall in love with what you're working on. It doesn't mean you're not going to hate it on a given day, and you will. If you're writing a novel for 2 years, maybe 186 of those days, you're going to be hating your book because it's hard work.
Mm-hmm.
But you need
mm-hmm.
to be able to love your novel even as you're hating it. It's an interesting dance, and I think it's one of the most important life lessons for a creative person to learn, how to love what they're working on even as they're hating what they're working on. Without that love, and all of the synonyms of love, enthusiasm, curiosity, passion, devotion, without that, you're not going to sustain your work over time.
Mm-hmm. I think that is what many people have a difficulty relating to. And I think when you meet someone, and I've known some artists that have done this, where they have been consistent and they have applied themselves, they've dealt with their frustrations, and then they get recognition and people will stand around and say, oh, aren't you lucky? And they'll go, what do you mean lucky? Maybe they've been doing it for 30, 40 years. Maybe like a Grandma Moses, they've done it for 50 years. And then all of a sudden there's a level of recognition. And age has nothing to do with it. It is something that, as you said, there is that joy. There is something that when you do it, there is a part of you that is fulfilled. There is a part of you that is nourished, and yet you've got to keep growing. You're never really satisfied. You can't be satisfied, because then you become apathetic. It's just the nature of life, I think. You study nature outside, and you'll find weeds growing up in cracks in the street, because Mother Nature says, you're not going to stop me. Wherever there is a space where I can grow, this is what I'm going to do. And sometimes it's in the most unlikely of places. And I think many times that's what happens with us in that creative spark of ourselves. We think we're supposed to be in a box where the creative self says, excuse me, no sides, no top, no bottom here. Let me breathe. Let me breathe. And then let's go to work. Then let's look at what we can do. And I just think it's exciting. I think it's marvelous. And that's what your book, Making Your Creative Mark, addresses. Now, I love this little Babylonian genesis that you have in the book, and I'm going to read it verbatim.
Okay.
I am a world builder. That isn't so easy. But I am a world builder, even with all my disabilities. I am a world builder. Desire is the complete prescription, whether I find myself at the beginning of a work of art, in the middle, or near its completion. Without desire, I am done. So every day, I rekindle my desire somehow. That can be rekindled by baking a batch of cookies, anything. It's an amazing process, and I really think your book addresses so much of that. Now, there's a segment in your book that I really appreciated, and that was the segment on psychological freedom. Talk about the various aspects of freedom, social freedom, career freedom, all of this. But it's the psychological freedom that we need to know is our rightful heritage. Let's talk about that, because that is vitally necessary.
It is, and Freud, who claimed not to know much about the creative process or creative people, and I think he was right. Of those early psychologists, Otto Rank was the one who knew the most about creative people, and he's the one who coined the phrase artist manqué for artists who, or would-be artists, who flee the encounter of freedom and can't get their work done. Freud, who said he didn't know much about art, said he thought he knew one thing, and that all creative blockage was self-censorship, psychological self-censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I think there's we engage in an awful lot of psychological self-censorship. This is the most obvious place where this is true is for the memoir writer, and everybody or every second person is writing a memoir these days, so this applies to a lot of people. The memoir writer often wants to tell her story, but at the same time, she doesn't really want to examine her marriage or her divorce or the things that she's writing about. And so she's stuck in this difficult, precarious, and not pleasant place of wanting to do something and at the same time refusing to do something. And this is why it takes memoirists often so many years to write their memoir, if they ever finish it. And mm-hmm. They may still be working on it 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years after they commenced, and it's because they don't want to look at the material, and also because of, so to speak, PTSD stuff, that it can be, you know, painful and anxiety-provoking to look at this material. It's one of the reasons I try to help clients make the distinction in their own mind between remembering something and re-experiencing something. That's, of course, one of the goals in PTSD work is to figure out how to do that for yourself so that you can remember something that you want to remember without having to re-experience it. So to make that long story short, we're defensive, tricky creatures. We all have our favorite defenses. And if we can learn what they are for ourselves and get a little bit better at penetrating our own defenses and feeling a little freer, that's wonderful. And the main freedom I think we need to latch onto or arrive at is the freedom to prove the exception. Because the rule is, you know, the rule is in the arts that most artists are not going to make it, unfortunately. The marketplace is hard. The work is hard. There are a lot of people fighting for slices of the pie. So if that's sort of Darwinian and the case, and it is the case, then if you, the given listener, you, the given artist, want to make it, you're going to have to prove the exception. And you're going to need to have the freedom to do more than the next person, to do things different from the next person. If you read in some book that you're supposed to send 7 emails, you have to send 14 emails. You have to do more. You have to prove the exception. You have to have the freedom. As you were saying before, most people want to go along to get along. They want to feel safe in the world. Most people want to feel safe in the world. Well, in fact, to be an artist, you have to be a leader and not a follower. You have to stand behind your own opinions. You have to have opinions. You have to have ideas. You're putting out material with your name on it. You're being an individual. And it's not so hard. It's not so easy to be an individual in a society that really reveres conventionality more than individuality.
Oh, I agree. One of the stories that you have in your book really brought back a very explicit memory as I was reading through it. You have a section in your book about making music and a story about a young woman, Annie. And what I wanted to do before you tell her story is say that I had been at an outdoor concert. This is when I lived in California. And there was a chamber orchestra, and there was this woman that was singing. She was tall, blonde, and she had this exquisitely gorgeous voice. She was a soprano. She sang her music, and I listened to her, and every note was perfect. Every single note was just marvelous. She was one of the worst performers I've ever heard of in my life. Now, someone may say, Donna, you're out of your mind. If she had all the right notes, why was she so bad? She had absolutely no feeling for what she was singing. There was just nothing. It was pitch perfect, but blah. And I just sat there and I go, how can someone do that? And your story about Annie brings the point home. Let's talk about Annie and her music.
You're going to have to refresh my memory a little bit about the details, because since these are concocted names, I probably have a client in mind, but I no longer remember who Annie is.
Annie is a violin virtuoso.
Ah, yes. Okay, that's all I need to know. Yeah. It's interesting to me that, to my mind, musicians are the least psychologically minded of my clients. I think the pressures are so great on them to get the notes right, that the performing itself is so hard, that there's some way in which their ability to think about what's going on in life is a little bit restricted just because they're so focused on hitting notes correctly. And as one famous pianist said, if you demand that I hit all the notes correctly, I can't make music. And that sounds crazy because we're so against making mistakes and messes. All day long, we're supposed to do things right, do things correctly. That's really how life is set up. We're supposed to do things correctly all day long. And then this moment is supposed to come where we have genuine freedom to make mistakes and messes in the service of creativity. And most people can't make that transition. And I think musicians especially, maybe jazz musicians the least, but musicians generally can't make that transition from, so to speak, perfection and hitting every note correctly and actually making music and moving another human being. So the headline here is a person needs permission, and this has to start early on from inside. A person needs permission to have more than an intellectual understanding of the value and power of making mistakes. They need that visceral permission. All of our most successful inventors, creators, what have you, they put their mistakes behind them almost instantly. They may have spent 2 years, you know, building a business that for some reason or other didn't work. They're not going to take that failure seriously. They're going to move right on to the next thing as best as they can. And so the headline here is that that's what we need to do for ourselves, is to not take mistakes and messes seriously, but understand that they're a genuine part of the process. Pundits who claim to know will say that Beethoven's first, third, fifth, seventh, and ninth symphonies are better than his second, fourth, sixth, and eighth. And I have no idea if that's true, but what I know is you can't do nine without eight. You can't do eight without seven. You can't do seven without six. You can't skip the things that don't work. And the more you fight to try to skip the things that don't work, the more you're going to turn out sterile, formulaic, rote productions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think so many times those people that have given to whatever, whether it's an actor, an actress on stage, there is something that when they really get in, we've all seen it. We've all seen people that supposedly were very good actors but couldn't empathize with their character. I think that's a good example. And you go, what's the matter with them? They're saying everything right, but it's just not there. And I think that there is that association, and you'll see it. I think Spencer Tracy, he's one of my all-time favorites. I just loved him. And when I watch these old movies, I go, wow, look at this guy. Look at how he was able to transition from one component to another. It was just amazing. So that, to me, I've just really enjoyed him as an actor. But I look at so many things in life, and people will come across as artificial, as sterile. But when you can really feel something, just like what you talked about music, it's not perfect, but there's something that happens.
That's right, and that is a certain freedom. It does require freedom, because everybody, your parents, your teachers, everybody's telling you to draw within the lines, do a good job, get ahead, get A's, do the right thing, and the creative process demands a different mindset from that. It demands going into the darkness, not knowing, loving. It demands all sorts of things that everyday life not only doesn't demand, but fights against. So I entirely agree.
Oh, I just think it's wonderful. I really think you have covered so much in your book, Making Your Creative Mark, 9 Keys to Achieving Your Artistic Goals. Now, some of you listening to us chatting today may say, oh, but I'm not an artist. Yes, you are. You've been given the gift of life. The canvas is the life that you're living. How are you going to take your canvas, your opportunity to express yourself, and bring it to life? I know a checker in a grocery store that every time she smiles and giggles, she is painting joy for everybody she comes in contact with. You can do the same thing. I think this book, Making Your Creative Mark, gives rise to understanding. Yes, we might have to have certain protocols when we're growing up, but I'll tell you what, adulthood gives you the opportunity to blossom. And that's what Eric Maisel does with this wonderful book, Making Your Creative Mark. And you can go to the website, ericmaisel.com, at ericmaisel, M like Mary, A-I like Ida, S like Sam, E-L, and also naturalpsychology.net. Both of those websites are available, and you can find out more of his writings. I mean, it's just he's just prolific. Eric, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thanks, Donna. It was great being with you.
It's been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go away. More good things to come. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via donna@delphiinternational.com
or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, and if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Now, someone had contacted me wanting to know if they could have a private session with me, and I want to let those of you listening know, yes, I do private sessions for people. All you have to do is give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. And if you get my voicemail, leave a message and leave your phone number, your name and phone number, and I'll call you back as quickly as I can. Sometimes it gets a little crazy around the office here, but that's all right. That's what makes life interesting. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Maggie Shannon. We're going to be talking about the art of crafting. Now, many times people say, I'm not a crafter, but Maggie has a way of presenting crafting with a totally different perspective, and I think you will enjoy our conversation quite a bit. Also, next week, we've got a very eclectic grouping of guests, which is not unusual for the Donna Sebo Show. We're going to be interviewing a young woman, Christina Ellis. We're going to find out how, before she went to college, she was able to raise $500,000 in scholarships that enabled her not to just go and get her bachelor's, but also her all the way through to her doctorate. All of her education was paid for, and she's going to give us insights into do that. Also, Seth is going to be with us next Tuesday. We're going to be talking about how he learned to smile from the inside. lessons learned from life itself, which he's going to say share with you. Darlene Price, if you have a challenge with public speaking, her book, Well Said, I think is going to be very inspiring to you. And also Beverly Flaxing, Make Your Shift. Well, this is something that we can do. If you're wanting to create something different, there's that creative part of you, whatever that might be in your life, we're going to find out how you can do it. And we may have a surprise guest next Friday, but that's up for grabs. It might also be an open mic day because I've had to reschedule my guest. We were going to be discussing stress, but he's been rescheduled for the month of June. That and much more we're going to be discussing on the Donna Cebo Show. You can always go into show information, hit that button here on BBS with the Donna Cebo Show, and you can find out about the guests that are coming up. Give me a buzz if you want to chat, 888-627-6008. Social media has changed communication big time. And there is so much that goes on, and all over the world, web-enabled phones are allowing us to communicate almost instantaneously. Now, this is a phenomenon that is having a huge effect politically on so many other different levels. In fact, I'm going to be getting a bit of an education this coming weekend because a friend of mine who is really into the high-tech industry is going to be bringing over what I call the new toys of life and educating me, and I need the education, believe me, on the sophisticated shifts and changes that are occurring in technology. If you're like me, sometimes you go, bleep, you bleep out because there's just so much happening. How in the Sam Hill do you keep up with it? Well, one of the most recent examples that really brought home the value of technology is that in October 2012, the New Yorkers that were hit by Hurricane Sandy, well, they had no electricity and they had very little cell phone service because stuff had been blown away, but they were able, because of what they had, to communicate information, emergency information, transportation updates, where gas station stuff was available, all kinds of things. And that is something that I think we're going to figure out a way where we don't have to have massive cell towers. And this is something that's going to be evolving. We're going to be developing a whole new level of energy that will allow us to communicate effectively and well. I always think of Star Trek, where the captain taps his chest. The spaceship can be hundreds or thousands of miles away, and they get the message. This is something that we're going to be seeing happening. There's going to be that communication capability. I think it is so very, very important. And there is a site called PinInterest. By golly, the U.S. Army is using 31 boards to connect service members via powerful images of Vietnam war heroes, long-awaited reunions, artwork submitted by soldiers, their families. Wow. What a shift. And keeping up with all of this is just amazing. And if any of you have suggestions on how we can stay up to date with this in an easy, effective way, send me some information. Send it to donnacebo@comcast.net or donna@delphiinternational.com. And lastly, there is timeliness is very, very important. And this particular story that I found out about really impressed me. It was about an individual, Chris Strauss, kidney disease. Chris was told he had to have a transplant, otherwise he was going to die. This is what he did. He went onto Twitter and just wrote these few words, I need a kidney. Within a very few days, 19 people stepped up and offered to be tested. And do you know one of them was a match? When this person was contacted, they said, yes, I will do the surgery because they will lose one of their kidneys. and the donor sent a get well message to Strauss because the surgery was successful, and sent it via Twitter. Communication, it is incredibly powerful. So we have a world where technology can be used to benefit. It also can be used to harm. So we always have a choice of how we are going to utilize it and how we are going to be able to make this world a better place because of it. So I wanted to share those stories with you. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. I want to share with you a bit of information about Kit Carson. Of course, he died in the 1800s. I think it was 1868. So I'm going to be sharing a little bit of history regarding Kit Carson. And if you're a shopaholic, are you one of those? Well, let's address that. Because I know there are some people that when it comes to shopping, they'll go and they'll buy all kinds of stuff, and then they get home and they say, well, I don't want this. This is all junk. I don't need this. Well, many times they're working with frustration. They, instead of facing something that they're anxious about, they just give in to the compulsion. Now, women are typically more prone to this, but let me tell you, there are guys with their toys, and they're expensive toys. And I was talking with a woman just the other day that said her husband wanted this type of a toy, and he wanted that type of a toy. And we're talking about $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of cash outlay for these items. And, of course, their credit cards have been maxed out. And she said, I just don't know what to do. So we had a very interesting conversation about that. However, this is something, whether you're female or male, you need to realize that you have to be aware, you have to be accepting, and you have to take action. And there is a woman by the name of Gloria Arenson, and she said when she's working with people, this is her specialty, shopaholic, she said, when I'm working with them, I ask them to rate the urge to shop on a scale from 0 to 10. If they say 10, she said, I want them to identify what is in their life that is also a 10, what is their super stressor. And once you trigger what your stressor is, now this can be with just about anything. Try it. If you are someone that's overeating and maybe you could eat 5 pounds of cookies in one sitting and you go, gee whiz, I can't lose any weight. Well, there's an obvious thing, but you feel like this is something that's a habit that you just don't know how to break. I think her suggestion is a very good one. It's in all levels. Then you just say, all right. When you become aware of what's stressing you, if your emotions are stressed to the max, you say, okay, this is where I am. I'm very unhappy. I'm out of 10. What can I do? And she recommended making a vision board of the goal that you want to achieve by breaking the habit that you may be recognizing. In this case, it might be shopping too much. And if you're dreaming of a trip to Hawaii, fill your board with pictures of this idyllic environment. Whatever the bigger goal is, you need to be able to see it, because in that instant when you look at the vision board, it will sort of ground you and zero in on your shopping trigger. And if you find that commercials on television push your buttons, put it on mute. Walk away. Go get a cup of tea or something. Break the patterning. Maybe have some knitting or whatever it is that you can do with your hands. Maybe a book that you pick up. Oh, commercials, boom. Put it on mute. This is what I'm going to do. It is really important. And if you love to go shopping with friends, okay, shift to something else if you know that you're trying to break this patterning. And also, you want to cultivate support from your friends. All I'm saying is you have a chance to shift and change your behavior and your attitudes. And, you know, we really are the ones that are in charge, and we have to do it. And sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes we're so critical of ourselves and beat ourselves up so much that we just beat ourselves down, and we just give up. I don't want you to do that. I want you to realize it's a brand new day. This is your life, and you can rewrite your script whenever you want to. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Have you ever had a paranormal experience, such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings? If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to donna@delphiinternational.com. Again, send your story to donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you. If you are an author and would like to be a guest on the Donna Sebo Show, please send a review copy of your publication along with a press release to the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for your material to be reviewed. Again, the address to send your material to is The Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I wanted to share a story with you about a man that I think just about everyone in America has heard of, and it's the famous Kit Carson. Kit Carson died at the age of 58 in 1868. Now, aneurysms, they knew something about aneurysms in the 1800s, but they really didn't know what they could do with them. Today, we have laser surgery. There are so many options that we can work with that were not available in the 1800s. But if you were diagnosed with an aneurysm, it was the kiss of death. Now, Kit Carson was a frontiersman. He was a trapper, a soldier, and an Indian agent. He was the personification of the early West and the style and the life that so many, many young people through the years, when they hear about the stories, just go, wow, it's like Lewis and Clark and all of these fabulous figures that we hear about in the time when this nation was still very, very young. Now, he developed this aneurysm, and it was pressed on a particular, it was on the pneumogastric nerve. And what happened with this? He actually would get bronchial spasm and intense chest pain. Now, this is what this man did before he passed away. He was smoking on a clay pipe. That's right. Now, though swallowing solid food was nearly impossible, he ate an immense buffalo steak, and he washed it down with some strong black coffee. And at the time when he was going through this, there was a new medical discovery called chloroform, and his doctor at the time used it to lessen his pain and suffering. And of course, with an aneurysm exploding, he would suffocate to death because of the massive amount of blood that would affect his capability to breathe. Now, what's so fascinating to me about this story is that he was in this unique time frame. His wife, Josepha, she had had a baby just a short time before, and it was their seventh child. Yes, women, there was no birth control at the time. And childbirth always has been difficult. It still is. It is painful. It is very difficult. You'll hear these romanticized stories about, oh, someone just had a baby. They didn't feel a thing. Well, I got news for you. Most women will be able to tell you about how terribly difficult it was. And in those days, women would get sick very, very quickly. Child mortality was exorbitantly high. The fact that they had seven children, and the children survived. And she died because of number seven. She got a very, very intense fever. She got an infection in the uterine area, and she was gone very, very quickly. So here is a newborn baby, six other children, and Kit Carson knows that he is going to be dying. And this was told to him because he had had a lot of problems with himself physically. In 1809, he was born in December, Christmas Eve day. That's when he was born. And he ended up, when he was 18 years of age, meeting John Charles Fremont. And John Fremont was a man who was the first Republican presidential candidate in 1856. But he was the one that encouraged Kit Carson to go for his dreams, because by the time he was 18 years old, he was just brilliant when it came to tracking. He was experienced as a fur trader. I mean, this young man, Kit Carson, was quite exceptional. And he had an amazing life. Kit Carson helped federal troops claim California for the United States. Friends in high office he had abundantly. Now, he was illiterate. I did not know that about Kit Carson. He could not read, nor could he write. Yet, he became the superintendent of Indian Affairs for the state of Colorado, or I should say Colorado Territory. Colorado wasn't the state at that time, until his death. An amazing man. And he did write his memoir in 1856. But when he became an Indian agent, he knew he had serious problems. He had this knot-like feeling in his chest, and he was diagnosed as having a heart problem, but a Dr. Chilton was the one that said, you have an aneurysm. This aneurysm, if it bursts, will cause your death because you're going to hemorrhage. So Dr. Chilton was with him as he went through this experience and assisted him with the new pain relief of chloroform. He died at 4:25 p.m. on May 23rd, 1868, and he was buried in Taos, New Mexico. And I didn't know that Kit Carson was a master mason. That's right, he was. And there's a simple epitaph on his grave. It says, he led the way. He and his wife were buried side by side. A fascinating story, I think, about a man in a time when medical care was very, very limited in its capabilities of really assisting wellness. And when you think of that, and when you think of where we are today, some people might say, well, I don't know. We still have a lot of the same challenges. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Because some of our biggest health enemies are little microbes, little tiny more organisms that you'll never see unless you have a super spectacular microscope to examine them under. This is a reality. Infection is something we still deal with today. That will always be the case. Because life is the way it is. Life feeds on life. But it's important for us to remember that we can take charge of who we are and we can make this world a better place, right here, right now. I know we are out of time. This is Donna Sebo. I'm so delighted you were able to share this with me. Won't you join me tomorrow, where we're going to be talking with a wonderful woman about how crafting is something. And it's, my goodness, there's no limit to the type of crafting that can be done, but how you can use it as a tool to empower you in your life. We're going to find out about that and much more. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Unleash that creative genius within you. You're so special, and I'm so delighted that you've shared this time with me. Join me again tomorrow. I look forward to having you here. Have a fabulous day or evening, wherever you might be. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.